The primary focus we have is trying to bring about peace in South Sudan. This is what we've been focused on since the 15th, 16th of December. And this week we've had a very good visit by the Minister of the Presidency, Awan Riak, who has been here in Washington, has had senior-level meetings with our National Security Advisor, with Secretary Kerry. I've spent several hours with him. We've had very fruitful and constructive discussions on ways forward to try to bring about an end to the fighting and to try to bring about a true political process that will address the underlying issues in South Sudan. So I think he's going back to Juba with some ideas to take back to President Kiir. As I said, we've had very constructive engagement with him over the past few days. And we believe that this is the type of approach that is needed. It really is going to be the political leadership from the government that's going to break the deadlock in the peace talks.
Let's get back to the sanction issue again. I mean, to the common man on the street, or especially the people in South Sudan, it sounds very broad. Yes, it's clear that it's not on the government. It's on people, selected people who are on the way of peace, who are obstructing peace. But it's not clear who are these people, when are the sanctions going to be implemented, and when will it bite the people who are intended for? Let's just start with who are these people exactly.
I have been warning, even since January. I made this statement at the IGAD summit at the end of January, that there would be consequences for those who continue to obstruct the peace process. I made that warning again in Addis last month. And so the executive order should not have come as a surprise to anyone. The United States has made clear its intent to focus on those individuals who commit gross violations of human rights, who obstruct the peace process, who circumvent the cessation of hostilities agreement. We issued the executive order, President Obama signed that, without designating anyone initially. We are looking at who we might designate, but we really want to use the executive order as a warning to those who are obstructing the peace process that behavior needs to change. And so we have not actually sanctioned any individual yet, but as I have continually warned, for those who continue to obstruct the peace process, we will take action. So I think we should look at this executive order really as an incentive, a carrot, if you will, to those who are trying to do the right thing. This gives them, I think, some additional room maneuver. It gives them some leverage over those who would obstruct trying to move forward in honoring the cessation of hostilities agreement, in moving forward the peace process, moving forward a true political negotiation, a true political process that will begin to address the underlying problems that South Sudan has faced.
A lot of analysts in the region are a little bit wondering, why is U.S. all of a sudden very harsh towards South Sudan? What are the reasons behind this new development?
As I've mentioned, we're looking at those people who through their actions, are harming the people of South Sudan, through their actions, are frustrating the peace process, through their actions, are encouraging the continuation of fighting. Those are the people that we're trying to influence through this executive order. Those are the people who need to change their behavior and to help the people of South Sudan achieve the peace that they've so long struggled for.
The news of these sanctions, the civil society organizations in Juba were very, very supportive of this sanction. They are saying, yes, it's the right thing to bring the leaders accountable. At the same time, the government is very negative about it. They are saying, well, this is U.S. interfering into their own affairs. What's your comment on this?
The reaction from civil society in South Sudan is indicative of the desire of a broad segment of people of South Sudan to see an end to this conflict and to see a real political process underway that will help to give South Sudan a chance for a new start, a fresh start, to build a country that will be inclusive of all of its people, that will have a governance structure that can accommodate the diversity of the country, the many interests of the country. So that is the purpose of our executive order. But I want to say that that is by far not the only thing that we have been supporting to try to bring about peace in South Sudan. As you know, we have been very supportive of the IGAD mediation. And I think South Sudan, as I've said on many occasions, is very fortunate that IGAD has stepped up to the plate and has put such senior negotiators such as former Ethiopian Foreign Minister Seyoum Mesfin and Kenya putting forward General Lazaro Sambewo, who was the mediator for the CPA. These are very experienced diplomats and negotiators who I think are really helping, trying to get the parties to move forward toward peace. The United States has been the major financial contributor to the monitoring and verification mechanism of the cessation of hostilities agreement. The verification mechanism was part of that agreement. We now have the headquarters established in Juba. There are monitoring teams that are in Bor and Bentiu, will be in Malakal as well. These teams need to be able to operate. We need to get the status of mission agreement concluded with the government so they can get out and do their jobs of actually verifying and reporting on who exactly is violating the cessation of hostilities agreement. And thirdly, and most importantly, one of the things that IGAD has proposed is the deployment of a regional force that will help to facilitate the work of the monitors, protect the monitors, and act as a deterrent to further fighting. And the United States is working very closely with IGAD to figure out a way to get that force deployed so that we can bring about, and I repeat this again, the priority is to bring about an end to the fighting. South Sudanese can start a true political dialogue on how to put their country back together.
Ambassador Booth, you have been in Addis right after the situation became very worst in Juba, and you've been talking to both sides on the need for ending the conflict in a very amicable way. And that took quite a long time. The talks have been on and off. Is U.S. frustrated by the progress at the peace talks?
Well, first, even before going to Addis, I went to Juba in late December. And I spent my Christmas and New Year's in Juba trying to convince the parties to go to the negotiating table. They did that at the very end of December, and they then went to Addis to join the in support of the mediators to support the peace process. Within a little over 3 weeks, the parties had agreed on the cessation of hostilities agreement. That agreement, as well as the companion agreement on the dealing with the detained former SPLM leaders, that cessation of hostilities agreement was achieved in that three-week period, was a very promising document. It addressed critical issues such as the delivery and movement of humanitarian assistance to the roughly million South Sudanese people who have been displaced by this conflict. But the problem is that over the 2 months since that agreement was signed, there has been constant fighting, constant violations of that agreement. So again, this is one of the reasons why we've supported the deployment of the monitors. We're supporting the deployment of the regional force, and we have moved forward with President Obama signing the executive order, again, to try to convince the parties that have not respected the agreement that they signed to do so.
U.S. has been a traditional friend of the people of South Sudan, and a lot of people in South Sudan are very happy with what the U.S. government has done for their people. People around the world call U.S. the midwife of South Sudan's independence. What is the leverage of the government of the United States in South Sudan?
The United States has definitely been a friend and supporter of the people of South Sudan. We stood with the people of South Sudan in the long struggle to be able to achieve self-determination for themselves. When they voted for independence, we supported that process. We have worked with the African Union High-Level Implementation Panel to try to ensure that the birth of a new South Sudan could enjoy a good relationship with its former self in Sudan, working on the issues of the border, the economic issues, the issues of dealing with the movement of people between the two countries. So we've tried to help normalize the relationship between Sudan and South Sudan. We remain a committed friend of the people of South Sudan. To the extent that we are able to, through with the staff that we have at our embassy, and to the extent that our implementing partners can safely operate in South Sudan, we are continuing the programs that help the people of South Sudan in the areas of health, education, agriculture. So we remain a firm and committed friend of the people of South Sudan. And most importantly, that's why we're engaged in trying to bring about an end to this conflict, to bring about an end to the suffering of the people of South Sudan who've suffered for far too long. And so we will continue to stand by the people of South Sudan. And we think that the best way to help them right now is to really focus on bringing about an end to the fighting and to get the political discussion to establish South Sudan on a firm footing going forward that will enable the country to exist in a manner that will not lead to future conflicts like this, that the people of South Sudan will be able to see a much brighter future for their children.
The two parties that have disagreed in Juba, that's the SPLM, and then that is formed by the former Vice President, Dr. Riek Machar. They call it SPLM in opposition. They have been meeting in Addis. What is your frank assessment of their commitment towards finding an everlasting solution to this problem?
Well, I think this is has been the challenge that the mediators and we have been trying to find a way to convince them that they need to start to make the hard political decisions that are necessary. First, to stop the fighting, to respect the cessation of hostilities agreement that they signed, and then secondly, to move on to serious political talks. But political talks that should include a broader range of South Sudan society. The important thing is that the people of South Sudan broadly feel that they have an engagement in putting their country back together, and that this is not something imposed upon them by a small political class. And so that's why we have been supportive of the IGAD call. And I reiterate that this is something that comes from the IGAD heads of state, that there be an inclusive process for addressing the causes and coming up with the causes of the current conflict and coming up with the solutions to that conflict. Obviously, it's the two warring parties that need to talk about how to implement the cessation of hostilities agreement. But to really address the underlying political and social issues underlying the conflict, you need to have a broader discussion. And so that's what IGAD has proposed, and we fully support that.
And what is the next step? Let's say the parties agree to go back to Juba and live under the same roof.
Well, as you know, South Sudan has already embarked upon an effort to draft a permanent constitution. Clearly, the process, an inclusive process again, of drafting a new constitution will have to go forward, determining what the governance structure going forward will be for the country. There are other issues that remain that have, unresolved that have been brought into the limelight as clear problem areas. The security sector, for example, needs to be truly reformed. Public financial management is another area. You know, there have been many reports of corruption. These issues need to be addressed. I think it's in the interest of the people of South Sudan, as well as all the friends of South Sudan, to ensure that the resources of the country are used to build a stable country, to build a country that will have an economy that is growing, that is diversifying, and to move away from the era of the liberation struggle and to move into that of real nationhood. And so that's really what we are prepared to work with South Sudan on. And we think, though, the most important thing is to stop the fighting. The fighting continues to displace South Sudanese. The fighting continues to put those South Sudanese who have been displaced, as well as many others, at grave risk of not only disease, but potentially in some areas of the country of famine. And the delivery of humanitarian assistance continues to be frustrated, even though the cessation of hostilities agreement guaranteed free movement for humanitarian assistance deliveries. We need to really address those specific issues. We do not want to see the people of South Sudan face famine or major disease outbreaks. We want to try to get a handle on this. But time is running out. The rains have already started. Once the rains come, it becomes much more difficult to move assistance to the people who need it. And so we need to get the fighting stopped. We need to get the cessation of hostilities respected, including that of delivery of humanitarian assistance. Now, in regard to the humanitarian situation, in my last visit to Juba a little over 2 weeks ago, I went with our Deputy Assistant Administrator of USAID, Nancy Limborg, who is in charge of the humanitarian assistance part of USAID. We went together as well as with a representative from our Refugee Bureau. We went to stress the importance of addressing the humanitarian situation, and one of the things we came away with is that the funding needs for that remain unmet. The United States has made major contributions. When I was in Juba, it was announced that there was another $83 million of humanitarian assistance that the United States would provide. But other countries need to step up and help the people of South Sudan as well. And so this weekend, tomorrow, we'll be hosting here in Washington USAID Administrator Raj Shah, and the UN and the European Union will be meeting with a wide group of potential donor countries to talk about the humanitarian situation and how it needs to be addressed.
And now the friends of South Sudan, including the United States, have been receiving criticism from the time the crisis started until today. And their story is this, that you left South Sudan, and especially the leaders, to do as it fits them. And so when the house was on fire, that's when you stepped in to put off the fire. What is your reaction to that?
Well, I think that's factually incorrect. In my own visit to Juba, before the conflict, I focused on a number of issues that were of concern. One of those concerns was the pending legislation that would have restricted the space for civil society. The U.S. had been engaged with the government on that, as well as with civil society, trying to convince the government that whatever legislation it passed that would deal with the civil society would leave space for civil society to operate. We engaged, while I was in Juba, as well as our embassy constantly on the issues of freedom of the press in South Sudan. We have engaged with the government on issues of corruption. So all of these things that we saw building to the crisis, those were issues we didn't discover on the 16th of December. Those were issues we have been working with South Sudanese leaders on since independence, on many of them. Again, in my visits to Juba as far back as September, which is when I first began as the special envoy, I met with the government as well as the opposition, the people who had been dismissed from their cabinet posts in July. I met with them and I made a constant message of you are risking coming up with a miscalculation. You need to be sure you don't burn down this new house of South Sudan. Unfortunately, on the 15th of December, there was a miscalculation, and I think everyone has seen how serious that was. This was something we have been warning. You can warn people, you can encourage people, you can threaten people, but at the end of the day, people will do what people will do. And so we're here to help the people of South Sudan. We're here to help their leaders who are willing to lead the country back to a peaceful and prosperous future.
South Sudan being preoccupied with its internal problems, how do you see that impacting on your effort to also find an everlasting solution for the problems in Southern Kordofan, Blue Nile, and Darfur?
Well, I think that the immediate things that that need attention from South Sudan and Sudan are the implementation of the September 2012 agreements that have to do with border crossings, with oil, with the movement of people and goods. Those issues, coming up with an agreement on the center line so that the demilitarized border area can be monitored. These are all important issues that need to be pursued. Obviously, South Sudan is a bit preoccupied internally. So again, another reason for moving to peace as quickly as possible so that these remaining issues with Sudan can be addressed. In terms of the conflicts within Sudan, this is something that I also spend my time working on. I've had many meetings with those that are unhappy with the government in Khartoum, as well as trying to engage the government in Khartoum to find some way forward to address the fundamental issues, which is the issue of how the center of in Khartoum deals with the periphery of Sudan. This is a story that goes back to the rebellion of the south. It remains not completely resolved in Sudan itself. And so one of the things that in one of my visits to Addis was also to be there during the talks between the SPLM North and the government to try to bring about a ceasefire or a cessation of hostilities in the two areas. So again, these are issues we continue to work on. We haven't forgotten about Abyei. Abyei is an issue that needs to be resolved. Again, that was going to require the attention of the South Sudanese government as well as the Sudanese government.
Friends of South Sudan meeting here in Washington to decide on how they will help this country out. But I want to take you back to the investment conference that was held in Juba before the whole situation erupted. A lot of goodwill was expressed, and in fact, leaders in South Sudan were saying this is going to be a start of development in the country. Now, with everything destroyed now, do you see the prospect of investors going back into the country and recommit themselves?
Investors look for stability and predictability. The less predictable and stable a situation, the higher rate of return they'll want for their investment. And so right now, given an ongoing conflict, I think it's very difficult to see investors going into South Sudan. On the other hand, I think the interest that was shown in South Sudan at that investment conference in early December, prior to the conflict, shows that there is great interest in the world's newest country. There's a lot of untapped potential for investment, for profitable investment, for investments that will help the people of South Sudan. So I think, again, this is one reason, another reason why we need to get beyond this current conflict. We need to silence the guns. We need to show the world, South Sudan needs to show the world, that it is addressing the political issues that led to the conflict so that it will build that confidence for investors to come back. South Sudan is going to need investment from the outside to create the jobs for its young people, to build the economy so that a country that lacks almost everything in infrastructure can begin to build what is needed for a modern economy.